ओम शांति। I know there's been quite a lot of conversations about what was raised during this morning and of course yesterday as well. So we will have some time for interaction, questions. This afternoon I'm going to talk for a little bit, then I'm going to show you another video. And I think that what I'm telling is really very new, hopefully a little disturbing. And it takes a lot of time for this stuff to sink in, because it isn't really there much in our BK environment, because generally speaking, people really don't make any distinction between conventional morality and spirituality. It's basically considered all one and the same thing. Have you found that? And what I'm doing here is saying no, it's not a continuum really. It is really two very different things, because the origins of both of them are very different. And if you noticed in Murali's, Baba talks to us about Gyan, Yoga, Dharana, Seva. And Dharana has very often been translated as inculcation of divine virtues. And then one of the things we do have, one of our pictures, which you don't see much these days, but it's there. And it's a picture, if you want to find it, you'll find it in a little book, probably in the literature store there. It's called Illustrations of Raj Yoga. And in that book, and there's a picture called The Pillars of Raj Yoga. And the pillars are, it's kind of a seat with nice, good, strong four pillars, and the yogi sitting on top. And the pillars talk about vegetarian food, and celibacy, and good company, and inculcation of divine virtues. And so you see the divine virtues here and there in what Baba provides us with. But in what we provide each other with comes this whole thing of values, ethics, and morality. And Baba has never mentioned any of those three in any Murali that I've seen. But he does talk a lot about divine virtues. And we really don't think about it much, but I want us to think about it a lot. That where do these divine virtues come from? Well, we always hear that they come from Baba, they come from God. But you're not quite sure quite how they got in. Is that right? Your divine virtues, do you have any? Is there a difference between a divine virtue and just a general virtue? But we always hear virtues described as divine virtues. We never heard of divine values. You just hear of values. And values you usually hear, you know, they can be Indian values, British values, Singaporean values, you know, Chinese values, African values. And so values tend to be qualified by some kind of a cultural or national expression. which actually validates my point that they really do come from people. And you know, one of the problems in the world today is immigration. Because there are, especially in Europe, they worried about immigration because the countries are pretty small, the populations are quite big, and there are people coming to different European countries from other countries where the economic situation or the political situation is more volatile. And then when people come from other cultures, of course they bring their culture with them. And then the local people say, yeah, but, you know, their values and our values, they just don't fit, you know. So you get clashes of values. Have you ever heard of clashes of virtues? Can you imagine a peaceful person clashing with a gentle person? You know, so values and ethics and morality have this cultural component. And again, what I mentioned earlier is they are actually invented by human beings. But virtues are not invented like that. They are more like something that is received. And so we say that Baba himself says that he is the ocean of virtues. Never heard him called the ocean of values or the ocean of ethics or the ocean of morality. I think we'd run a mile if we heard that, don't you think? Because morality is connected with this idea of moralizing. You know, moralizing has these expressions like should, you should do this, you have to do that, you can't do the other, things like that. So there's a lot of injunctions. But and it's all to do with behaviors and dress codes, and you know, Murali Baba said it doesn't matter what you wear as long as you're soul conscious. And once in Brazil, everybody came to class in white bikinis, in Rio I think it was, because they thought they should wear white, and the sisters were a bit, you know, no, we've got to have, you know, a little bit more. Because it's a culture, you know, it's a culture of the beach and the carnival and all this, you know. So all of these are really man-made things, and they're kind of imposed. It's very difficult to impose a virtue on someone. Virtues have to be received, or they have to be discerned. And so they're really very different. And the video I'm going to show you talks about the role of God in values. Because what we want is not that we don't want to have any morality, ethics, or values. We do. But we don't want to have, I think, values, ethics, and morality that is created by, invented by, and imposed on us by body-conscious people with Tamil Pradhan intellect who got their information from other people of a similar description through several generations. And, you know, the time when all of these traditional values were created, I figure it goes back to the Iron Age. And so people were maybe not Tamil Pradhan, but they were Tamil. They didn't have knowledge of God. And after that, the quality of human existence continued to decline through another 42 births, right? So that means whatever it is that we have inherited, people who believe in tradition, there's a certain ambivalence about it, because on the one hand, they talk about the good old days, that it was better in those days. But on the other hand, they believe in evolution. You see, so if it was better in those days and we're progressing, then it must be really good now. And if it doesn't look good, it's just because we're not looking in the right direction. But that really isn't working. And so one of the things that Baba has told us in the spiritual paradigm, we saw about the material paradigm and the spiritual paradigm. So the material paradigm says we are in a state of evolution and progress. Whether you like it or not, we are. You know, whether you agree with it or not, we are. This is the position, you see. And then Baba comes along and he says, well, you know, when I left you, it was heaven, you were rich, you were nice, you were beautiful, you had lots of virtues, lots of wealth. And then, after a 5,000-year absence, I return and I see, you know, what kind of a catastrophic, poverty-stricken, mutual, violent behavior is going on. How can you call that progress? You know, and as we pass from gold to silver, there's a decline in value, which is characterized by a decline in values. And then we go to copper, which is another decline, and iron, pretty low value. And then, the confluence age is called the diamond age. And diamond is, of course, made of carbon. So when we come to Baba, we're resembling more like pieces of coal, which have to be subjected to intense heat and pressure to be turned into the kind of diamonds that we are attracted by, those absolutely transparent, beautiful, indestructible crystals, you see. And Baba also talks to us about the stone intellect being transformed into the diamond intellect. And of course the diamond, or the intellect rather, is all connected with conscience. So I was tossing between two videos. This one is the role of God in values, and the other one I was thinking to show you is all about human conscience, you see. Because when we're talking about, you know, the external moral authorities, the parents, the teachers, the religious leaders, these are the people from whom we receive these received values, values and ethics and morals. But we also have to create our inner moral authority, which is the activated conscience. So I have another one on the activated conscience. And in fact, I'll give you a choice, if you would like, which one you'd like to see, the activated conscience or the role of God in values. Would you like? Activated conscience? Anybody? Activated conscience? Okay, let's put a show of hands. I might have to show you both. Activated conscience, who likes that? Okay, that's not too many. Okay, role of God? It seems to be a majority. A couple of hands there. Well, no, they're both of them very relevant. And if you want to see these things, I have 15 of them on the YouTube. And what you'd have to do is go onto the YouTube and punch in Denise Lawrence. And there you'll come to my YouTube channel. And there's tons of things that will come up when you do that. you know, try and find the right one. And it says YouTube channel, and it's got my photo, so it should be easy enough. And there you'll see a whole bunch of videos, and one of them is the series of virtues, values, ethics, and morality. And in there you will find 15. Now, there's a total of 60, but I just put 15 of them on the YouTube. And I put them there because, you know, these ideas are relatively new. And, you know, it's possible to be karmatite and fascist. Now, people don't realize that. Fascist is very right-wing political, you know. I mean, you can also be karmatite and liberal. So your political orientation, notwithstanding, you see. And a lot of people, they think that if you're spiritual, then you have to be of a certain political alignment and a certain social attitude and so on. And it actually doesn't work like that. So these are things for you to discover and raise your eyebrows at. and that also helps you to understand some of the very strange mysteries about what spirituality is and what are our assumptions about it, you see. Because as you wrote in your little writing exercises, there is still a great deal of the conventional morality embedded within all of us. And it is exactly because of this that Brahmins experience, you know, disagreements with each other, clash of values, clash of their attitudes towards what's important, what's right and wrong, things like this, you see. And there's a lot of social or prevailing social attitudes that you may have grown up in and assume that that's the same thing as a spiritual virtue or a divine virtue. And somebody else who's grown up in a different set of ethics, a totally opposite view, but they're still keen on divine virtues. So it's a great mystery. Now, how is this possible, that you can be highly conservative and karmatite, or you can be highly democratic and liberal and also karmatite? You see, so that your political orientation has nothing to do with it. You could be a homophobe and karmatite. Right? You know what I mean by that? Someone who says that you're only okay if you're heterosexual. You see, but for us, you know, you got to be celibate. Doesn't matter which way you want to go, you have to be celibate. So don't worry about it. Be celibate. But some people say, no, you got to be celibate only if you're heterosexual. If you're not heterosexual and you're celibate, doesn't count. Excuse me, of course it counts, you know. So you see how these prevailing social attitudes interfere and sort of they corrupt our ability to comprehend what spirituality is. So that's why it takes a lot of investigation and analysis, you see. I mean, there are some people who think human rights are very spiritual values. And there are some people who have all kinds of divine virtues that don't agree with half of the human rights, you see, because of casteism and things like this, you see. So it's not what you think. And when we make assumptions which are never discussed, then sometimes you just don't know that you're speaking at cross purposes with people because of assuming that everyone has the same orientation as you on political or social subjects, and guess what? They don't. And you can still be spiritual, you see, and coming from really opposite angles. But when it comes to virtue, the virtues themselves, the divine virtues, actually neutralize all of these social and political considerations. Because if you are kind, gentle, cooperative, considerate, generous, then you're not causing any harm to anyone. And so, you know, the values tend to polarize people in one left or right, you know. Virtues don't. It's just you're a human soul, child of God, who has been the recipient of all of these virtues of God. So what happens is, from Baba, we get these foundational qualities, which are what I call the elemental qualities of the soul: purity, peace, power, love, and bliss. And you need these five because they have to be 100%. That's your foundation. That's the base of your building, of your stage. And then on top of that, you cultivate all kinds of virtues. And virtues are always shown as flowers, right? So you have in your garden of virtues all sorts of flowers according to your personal preference. And the thing with flowers is, you know, well, the deer will eat them up. I don't know if you've tried having a garden in country where there's deer, they will immediately eat them up. Or some birds will eat them up or something. There's always going to be creatures who will say, that looks like really good kind of lunch, you know, that you nicely put out for me. And so chomp, 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 and that's the end of your flowers. Or you get some people who would just walk all over them and squash them. So flowers have to be protected. And so in order to have a good stage, along with your foundation of the five elemental qualities and your virtues, you also have to have the powers. Because your powers are your defense against any predators who might come along and try and mess up your state of mind, or give you some sorrow, or something like this. And as you heard earlier, taking sorrow is an act of sin, you know? So how will you not take sorrow unless you have all the really solid powers, you see? Otherwise, you're finished, you know? People who are very, very spiritually sensitive, very vulnerable, you see. So if you don't have the powers as a kind of dome, you know, in Israel, I was there in Israel. Is anybody from Israel here? Yes, yesterday we had. But in Israel, during the time I was there, there was a conflict going on. And they had a thing called the Iron Dome, which protects the city. So any time a missile would come towards Tel Aviv or somewhere, and then the Iron Dome would be activated and another missile would go and it would shoot down that missile, and then everybody have to go in the air raid shelter while the pieces of the two missiles fall down, which took about 10 minutes. Then you can come out and carry on as usual. But we need some sort of a dome over us so that we can protect this beautiful, delicate garden of virtues that we're creating or cultivating, and the seeds of which are given to us by Baba, by God. Okay, so let us look at this virtue, this video about the role of God in values, and then afterwards let us spend some time question and answer, okay?
Hello, welcome to Values, Virtues, Ethics and Morality. This program is an invitation to join myself, Magla Pillay, and Sister Denise, who has been a Raja Yoga teacher with the Brahma Kumaris for several decades. The format of this show is the Socratic Dialogue. This means a philosophical method of systematic doubt and questioning of another to elicit a clear expression of a truth supposed to be knowable by all rational beings. We will be taking up a variety of subjects related to moral and ethical values. We will be questioning some of the world's conventional views on these matters. We will analyze and dialogue the topics in order to gain greater insight and perhaps even uncover new foundations as to how we formulate our value systems. Everyone is concerned about doing the right thing. Paradoxically, it has been found most people act against their own conscience. We will be investigating why this is so. Sister Denise, very, very warm welcome to today's show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Today we're going to look at the subject of the role of God in the setting of values. Now, when I look at my value system, I don't actually wonder what role God plays in it, but maybe you have a different view?
Everyone creates their own value system as they go through life. And most people are influenced by the values of their external moral authorities, which are their parents primarily, then the education system and the religious context in which they've grown up. And then at a certain point in time, a person likes to just see and check and evaluate. Do I really believe this? Do I subscribe to this? The influence is very strong, so generally they do. But what I have found is that most ethical systems, moral systems, are based in the materialist paradigm. And by analyzing it and checking it against conscience, I found that there are some problems with it. Now, one of the attributes of God is who God is called the one who knows all things. And one of the things that God knows is the difference between matter and spirit. And when you consider people are spiritual beings operating through material bodies, then this is one of the things that God addresses, is the fact that we need to identify with the self as a spiritual being, and the fundamentals of spirituality, which are the foundation qualities of purity, peace, power, love, bliss, which I've mentioned a few times. So, what God says is two or three very, very important things that people need to know. One is that every human being is a soul, and none of them are objects. Every human being is a human soul, so a human soul doesn't become any other kind of soul, an animal soul or plant soul or any other kind of soul. Also, what we have learned from God is that everyone is depleted, which is why the materialist paradigm has come in. Because when you're spiritually depleted, you identify with matter, and you take your sustenance and your source from matter. and this has depleted people even more. So I suppose we can say the message of God is, do not take sustenance from people, places and things. Take sustenance from the one who really can sustain you, which is the being of God, which is the source of the power that a human soul needs in order to operate in such a way that the actions you do are not against your best interests. So this is really the role of God in setting values.
Like you said, people across the globe set their own value systems, but it's quite obvious that if one looks at what the world has become, people's value systems do not work for them anymore. But yet they find themselves in a position of being unable to look outside their immediate environment for an answer as to what can work for them. So what would you say to somebody in that position?
I would say that if your existing system isn't working for you anymore, that is a trigger for you to start looking around. Some people, they say, well, my religion has not provided me with what I hoped for, and they become disappointed. Then they will look around at other religions or other philosophies, thought systems, moral philosophies, or whatever, and they will just try out different things until they find something that seems to be right. A lot of people just go from one to the next and never really find something, so they become a bit lost. Some people, they say, well, the only thing I can trust is myself, so they go back to themselves, but then if the self is corrupted and sort of distorted from the original condition, which of course everybody is, you can't find anything reliable. So for me, I think that, you know, the search for truth and the search for God and the search for the self converge, absolutely. And I think a person will just keep going until they find something that really suits and fits the criteria of I need to be right with myself. Mm. And I think also that the being of God is very active at this time and very responsive to the human quest for truth and for finding the right way to navigate their lives, so that that energy is human beings more into alignment, whereas previously they've been very much in a way at odds.
Mm-hmm. Denise, one finds that, I want to give you an example, and I would like you to tell me what you think in this scenario. A boy of 8 years old sees a person from a particular race different from his own, physically attacking his father. And from then on, he has learned to despise people of that race because of what he has seen. Another scenario is a 14-year-old girl who sees her mother financially ruined by somebody of a different culture, or maybe just a different gender from the one that she's in. So then she has a particular fear or the need to protect herself from people who look like that or people that are like that. So a lot of what people have become is in relation to a negative experience. And so they set their value system, in inverted commas, accordingly. They don't necessarily go and attack people of that particular culture or race. They simply protect themselves from it. What would you say to somebody who finds themselves in that position?
Well, I think it's quite unlikely that they would base a value system on one incident. Mm. I think it would have to be a whole series of incidents through which the person builds up a conviction inside that, yes, I have example after example after example that this is the case, and that would generate an attitude of that nature. And they would not change it until they see good reason to change it.
Yes, so we all sit with mindsets based on negative experience that has become part of our own value system. You don't trust the people of this and this culture for this and this reason.
I don't think it's quite as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people build their value systems on the basis of their conversation with their own conscience. And when they see and experience traumatic events, then that will put a bias.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that would be the foundation.
Okay. You mentioned the God being active at this stage. If somebody is quite devoted to resetting their own value barometer, as it were, they want to reset that, and they want to become a better person because they want to become more honest, become more good at communication, etc. How would you actively include God in that?
Did you say a devotional person?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I feel that first of all, you have to see what triggers a person's decision. I want to be a better person. It would have to be some sort of trigger. Mm. It might be that they did something quite bad that they had to face. That would make them realize that, hey, yeah, that wasn't good. You know, when people get away with things, they never have to face it. But as soon as they don't get away with it, that's really good, because then you have to really look at it.
Mm.
And you have to really look at yourself. And that could be a good cause of sitting with the self and saying, okay, now what do I really believe in?
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be that everything that their life was based on all of a sudden collapses, because that does happen to people. It happens to quite a lot of people so frequently that in fact it comes into the general examples that people pick up. Because a person had a belief that if I do this, this, this and this, everything will be fine. Maybe they were told that. And then all of a sudden the whole thing collapses. They are at a loss. They have to rebuild everything from zero. And so they have to really sit down with themselves and think. And they may go through a load of emotions around such a situation. So it could be that a person who has figured out their values comes into the life of that person. And then they bring that influence, and that's a positive thing. On the other hand, you can come in contact with someone very cynical and decide to abandon the whole question of values altogether. So there are many different possibilities that can happen in such moments.
Okay. So now such a person can make a conscious decision to include God in the rebuilding of them, of themselves.
Okay. I don't know if it would happen like that, because under what conditions does a person turn to God from not being involved with God?
Okay.
Usually it's when things go really wrong, okay, and they turn to God as an absolutely last resort.
Okay. My question is, how do you include God into your value building process at that
There'll
stage.
Be lots of different ways that people do it.
Mm-hmm.
They may do it in an emotional way. They may come across someone from one or another of the religious traditions who may bring that particular angle on God into this person's life. You just never know. But suppose a person comes in contact with Brahma Kumaris with that background, then we would encourage them to sit down and really think about what is their relationship with God, and do they believe in God, what do they think God is, what does God mean to them, and we would expose them to the study of Raj Yoga, which talks about God, the soul, time, eternity, karma, so many of these things. And if a person responds to that study and gets something out of it, then they can go deeper and deeper. And then they could bring in God into their lives very well. But that you have to see on a case-by-case basis.
Oh, okay. There are people whom I know personally who do not have God in their lives at all and yet have a very high value system.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I met such people whose lives work for them. I find them very interesting because they are able to manage their lives pretty well. Does God have a role to play in their lives? And it's their choice, obviously, is it not?
Obviously, yes. And what I would say is that the truly spiritual values and virtues originate in God. And if a person has very good values and they don't have God in their lives, but maybe in a much earlier period of time, they would have. They would have, you know, sometimes people don't have God as an anthropomorphic presence. Sometimes people have God as a set of truths. You know, people believe in God that way also, you see, not as a personal God, but there are some people who say good is the same as God, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different ideas out there and ways that people relate to criteria.
Yeah.
And this is where I think also the conscience helps us, because you do refer to your conscience. And your conscience is part of your soul, and your soul at some point had to have had an encounter with God, which sets the direction of your life, of your soul, you see. So that the connection with God may be very tenuous from a conscious point of view, but very strong in a more subconscious level from an ancient past.
Mm-hmm. I've been in this position myself, and I've seen others as well, where you do something that looks right on the outside, but with the wrong intention, and where you do something with the right intention, and on the outside it's wrong, as it were. We human beings, I think, are fond of getting themselves into such, drama, as it were. What is the effect of that? When is a value real? And what determines the reality of the value? In other words, that you get good return from it. What is the determining factor?
For me, intention is very important. A lot of people are concerned with how things look. Does it look right? If it looks right, then it is right. If it looks wrong, then it is wrong. That's quite a superficial way of approaching it for me. I give a lot of importance to the intention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a person holds an intention internally, and they will check that with their conscience,
mm-hmm.
and then they will get a feeling of what action to take. And to the outside, it may look really strange, but it would be a really very good action based in spiritual value.
Okay, so intention is important.
And your motivation, yeah.
Are intention and motivation the same thing?
They're very, very close. They may not be identical, but they're very close.
Okay, so one should look to one's intention and one's motivation before performing. Okay. Yes, Sister Denise, is one's value system, is it permanent or is it malleable? And by that I mean, if you're, there's a person who's got a good solid value system, do they treat everybody the same, or do they treat people differently?
Well,
does it change from person to person?
You've got several questions. First question is that do the values change? And yes, they do, because as you move through life, you change, and your experience causes you to rethink your way of looking at life, I think, from time to time. And I think you do work with people differently. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all, because each circumstance, at least what I learned in Raj Yoga practice, is that it's very wise to take each situation case by case, because situations are not the same. They may be similar, but they're never exactly the same. So we are always taught very much to look at what's known as the three aspects of time of every situation. So you need to take a look at how the situation arose. What are the factors in the past that made this happen in the present? And then you also have to look at where it's going. And if you take an action, that means that you're bending the trend of that situation this way or that way, which also means that you can calculate the outcome. And so we are taught, you know, really look at what kind of outcome is the best that could be for this situation, and then what action would lead to that outcome. And in that way, you decide upon your actions. And I think if you do that for many situations, you'll begin to see patterns in your way of acting and also in the kind of circumstances that come to you, and you will begin to formulate your policy.
You're obviously a very deep thinker. Does a rock solid value system that works for you belong to deep thinkers only or not? My point is, not everybody thinks about values and everything else we discuss on the show to the depth that you do. Taking things to their core, to their essence, part and parcel of what you just think?
Well, it's part of me, definitely, as you observe, but I think that it's part of many people. You know, those people who think, those people who are introspective, those people who, you know, really seek to understand how the world is and how things work and why are they this way and not that way, you know, they will come upon something that is stable and solid. And I think people do look for a stable reference point. Sometimes people are not willing to make it themselves, but if they see someone else who's doing the work, they'll piggyback, and that's valid. Or they will take inspiration from someone. They look for role models and mentors. So that's how really I could look at it.
Sister Denise, there are young people listening to you right now who are rethinking their lives, who are having a good look at their value system, and whose life is in the process of transition from their youthfulness to young adulthood, and who are at odds on some level or the other, but feel deeply inspired having heard you. What would your message be to a young person who wants to make something of themselves, but not at the expense of their conscience?
Well, exactly that. I would say that give a lot of time to yourself, think, consult your conscience. Almost as if your conscience is one voice, and then you is another voice, the mind, consulting the conscience. You know, the mind is the aspect of the self where you're moving from one side to another. It's quite unstable. But the conscience is much more stable, more calculated, more mathematical in a way. And the two sides of the self are very essential, but they need to be in conversation with each other, because if you use one without reference to the other, your actions will be somehow incomplete or inappropriate or lacking feeling, you know.
Mm.
So these things must work together, and they have to be balanced, and give time, introspect, spend time with yourself, and trust yourself.
Trust yourself. There will be people watching the show who were born into a religion, culture, race, part of the world that teaches them a set of values, but then they come to a point when they realize that it doesn't work for me anymore, I want to be someone else. But then together with that decision, there comes along with it a feeling of betraying who their family, their culture, their religion. And that betrayal can be a very heavy burden to carry. How would somebody deal with that?
I would say, get a piece of paper, put a line down the middle, and put the pros and cons, and really try and calculate. Put all the things that your conscience says, all the things that the value system that you grew up say, and try to calculate the total of each column. And see which one adds up to the highest positive amount and go with that.
Okay.
Because even if you are betraying some people who with very good intentions taught you a certain way, but if you work out that there is a moral system, an ethical policy that corresponds to you better than the legacy that they gave you, then your first loyalty must be to yourself.
Yes.
And then you have to find a good way to communicate to them your independence and also your appreciation and recognition of their value, but you do not allow yourself to be taken hostage on the in the thought that if I betray my loyalty to these people and sell out myself, that that's a good idea. That's not a good idea.
There are far too few people in the world who know that their first loyalty is to themselves. Is there? Why is that?
Partly the message is, you must be loyal to me because I am your mother, your father, your teacher, your guru, your mentor. You are, you know, someone who doesn't know. I am someone who does know. So you do get this, you know. And it's something that eventually the person says, I'm grown up now. In a way, you can only really be free when you have become an orphan.
Okay, what does that mean?
Because this
that's a bomb, Sister Denise. Okay, we have to take on the show for another half an hour. There you go. What does that mean?
When you're an orphan, you're it. Your parents, they have, in a way, they have power over you, and you owe them. Your teachers, all of these people who have raised you, you owe them. But when you're an orphan, you're really free in that you don't owe them anymore. And you find yourself alone, so really you are free, but then you're also alone. So it's six of one and half a dozen of the other. And that also takes strength to be alone and to be an orphan, because then other people start looking at you you start sustaining them. But you have to try to be very careful in your relationship with people who are taking their moral cues from you, that you encourage them in critical thinking. Critical thinking doesn't mean being critical about people. Critical thinking means that you really think deeply and you critique the ideas. And this is why we're doing a Socratic conversation, because that's what it's about. You critique the idea, and if the idea stands up, good. If it doesn't stand up, into the waste paper basket.
Hmm.
And that's very hard in a way, but if you're prepared to do that because you have such love for yourself, such regard for yourself, then you become a person with great integrity.
Okay. Well, that was quite a power-packed half an hour. Thank you very much. Sister Denise has shared from her own experience what the role of God is in setting our value system. Sister Denise has shared quite a bombshell, as well it was to me. I wonder if it is to you as well, that one can only be free when one has become an orphan. I need to think more about that, and I invite you to do the same. So we're looking at setting of our value system, that intention matters as much as your external, as much as your action and words itself. And also Sister Denise asked us to introspect and spend time enough with yourself, engage with your conscience so that you can become the person that you would like to be. Sister Denise, thank you very much for your time and your wisdom, and we thank you at home for joining us today, and we hope to see you again soon. Thank you and goodbye.
Om Shanti. So you can see that it gets quite complicated as you go digging around inside. Let's think about it. Om Shanti. So you see, it's not quite so easy, Raj Yoga. And many, many things to take into consideration. But this is really what I'm keen to have us do, is really, you know, our reference is Baba, Srimat, all of this. But then each one of us has to set our own value system. There's another one called building your own personal ethical policy. So, let's see if any of you have some questions, something or comments or something you'd like to share, which has been raised by your participation in today. Is there anyone? We've got a mic up here. Yeah, please, come.
Yes, in your later part of the speech, you said the orphans are free. I feel that orphans are very insecure, unlovable, they don't trust anybody, and they don't
wait,
have...
Wait. I'm not talking about children. I'm talking about when you reach about the age of 60, 70, that's when you become an orphan.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, because that then you have to deal with when your parents die, in the normal course of things. I'm not talking about little kids.
Oh, okay, fine.
No, I don't deal with kids at all. I deal with our age group.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was just thinking.
So, are your parents alive?
No.
So you're an orphan. But you're okay, right?
Yes, I'm okay.
Yeah.
I have my own children.
Yeah, but a time will come when you die, then they'll be orphans.
Yeah.
You know, and so usually when you think of this word orphan, you think of little kids in some orphanage being abused, you know, and that's horrible. But actually, anyone whose parents are dead, they're orphans. But you never think about it like that.
Yeah.
Because you're adult. But my point is this, that as long as your parents are there, they have power over you, and you have obligation, and so you have to do what they want, follow what they say, in order to be a good person. And a lot of people, when they have discharged their responsibility to their aging parents, that's when they really come into their own. That's when they become free.
Yeah, paradoxically, the other question also arises in my mind now. In young age, when you are very young, at that time, the children who are orphaned, you know, how do we give morality to them?
We're not dealing with that subject. But okay. The thing is this, any child who has experienced some sort of trauma in young age, which is 99.9% of all children, they have to deal with that trauma. You know, a lot of people grow up in more or less dysfunctional families. Anyone who grows up in an alcoholic family, which is quite a lot of people, they're in trouble. Because they grow up in an environment which is completely chaotic and inconsistent, and usually violent and emotional neglect. So that's traumatic. You might as well be an orphan, because your parents aren't able to discharge their duties due to their addiction. You see, so there's a lot of people in that situation. And then there's an epidemic called domestic violence, you see. And there is, you know, the thing that they've been talking about a lot in India, this Eve teasing, there's harassment, there's gang raping and so on, which is going on. And it's not just in India, it's very widespread, you see. And so all these traumas, they damage the soul dramatically. And so there's a lot of people who have to heal from those things. Anyone who has grown up in a war situation has been badly traumatized. There's quite a lot of wars going on right now. Anyone who has been directly affected in a natural calamity, you know, and there's quite a lot of those going on as well, where in a day your whole life is turned upside down, half your relatives are no longer there from one day to the next, you know, there's all these things going on. Or another thing which is happening is people get sick, you see. So if you are a child and all of a sudden your mother gets sick, gets cancer, gets, you know, something like this, and is unable to take care of you, you become vulnerable. The carers may not care for you properly. You may be exposed to something that a child should never be exposed to, and that will affect you for the rest of your life, you know. And then you have a couple of traumatized people who get married, creating a double trauma, who then have children who grow up in that double trauma marriage. You see, so life on Earth at the moment is pretty difficult because of all these things that are very subtle and in many cases not quite as visible as you would think. And I mean, if you look at the percentages, the statistics that the different agencies come up with in terms of this, you would find that the majority us sitting here in this room have been exposed to severe trauma, and here we are in BK. And we have to deal with that. And this culture is not one which says that you can talk about these things. It's one which says that you don't talk about these things. And so you have to manage your trauma while putting on a nice sweet smile, handle your crazy mind while conducting Amrit Vela, you know, in a nice way for all these people in front of you who think that you look like really spiritual and where all hell is breaking loose inside your head. And but you can put on a mask, you see, and we're very good at that. But it doesn't mean that by doing that, that you are actually moving through those things and becoming free and sort of de-traumatized. It's very deep work. And Baba gives us what we need in terms of he's always there for us. And it doesn't matter what happens, your connection with God will outlive your own body. Because as a soul, we are connected with Baba forever, you see. And he's always going to be our father. But it's only in this birth that he actually comes through Brahma Baba and plays out that. And that's at the time when we are at our most depleted, with all of our karmic accounts and all of our traumas and dramas and whatnot and so forth. And Baba does tell us how to take power from him and how to, you know, take all the love and all of the wisdom and everything. But not everybody knows how to do it so well. Some people have difficulties with it because of many reasons. And, you know, for us to go into these, you know, deep down territories, that's a bit of a taboo subject. But when you start to look at making a distinction between the values, the morals, and the ethics, which are all designed to cover up all that stuff on one side. And then you leave there and you go into Baba's world, the world of virtues, the world of spiritual powers. And then you can actually return to your original condition. And of course he talks to us about drama and karma and all these things. But unless and until we work with these things in perhaps a deeper way than we normally do, our progress may be slower than we would like it to be. So it's interesting that you raised all that, because yeah, it's underneath this veneer of everything is okay. Underneath there are many things that are really not okay, but we can cover it up, you know? And there needs to be, you know, a safe environment, a pure and clean environment in which, you know, Baba sometimes speaks of this as a hospital for souls. We have our nature cure and all that. So he does talk about it. He does raise it, but we don't necessarily develop that side of Raj Yoga, but we could if we wanted to, you know, and maybe we should. Anybody else like to? Yes, please. So, Kim, and then you come up and say it on the mic.
Oh, yes, enlightening and illuminating. A few things. One, just perhaps briefly touch on the aspect of virtues and your understanding of divine virtues, and you're talking about Baba giving it to you, so how we can move into that and discriminate, or, you know, how do we get that blessing from Baba or boon from Baba? The brother brought up this morning, how much power do I give to others? So just taking up the aspect of this morning, we kind of agree with the map, or at least to a large degree, that you've given us in the morning. So what do I do now, you know, to come out of that and come into Baba's world? Do I just totally focus on Baba's world and that will all be taken care of? Or is there something more proactive to do? And maybe also within that, you touched on the aspect of how to take power from God and all the love and wisdom that Baba really wants to give us. So is there some kind of simple formula that I can touch that will, I will know that I really am going that deeply into what Baba's giving me, and I'm not just faking it or doing it superficially. So a few things. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a complex question statement. Well, when we do our chart, and we do our chart different ways on different days, and a lot of people don't do their chart because it's too mysterious. We don't know what to do or how to do. How can you figure out how and what is your percentage of yoga? It's probably 0.0001 on any given good day. But you don't want to write that because it looks rather small. So, you know, when you are, if you just take yourself back to the Murali, the Avyat Murali of the 15th of March, and Baba was saying, you know, Vah, my children. And I can hear the songs of love in your heart, which you can't hear because they're, you know, in the mind space. But Baba can hear them. And he was really, you know, taking us into a connectedness with him using extremely simple expression of Va Baba, Mera Baba, Va children. And there was a bunch of people in the audience who were going like this, like, what's he talking about? You know, why is he so repetitive and this and that? Kami has some of that old stuff, you know, where he gives us a lot of complications and things. You know, and so they were actually not in yoga. But some of you may have really gone into it and just gone with the flow and just experienced, yeah, you know, I'm with Baba, and Baba's with me. And that's, after all, what yoga is, isn't it? You have to do a lot of churning in order to get in yoga, but then when you're in yoga, then you're not churning anymore because you're there. And he was really taking us there, right there, and saying, wow, you know, do you realize, you know, this is me and you, and we're together. And it's amazing, right? And I think that when we are in yoga with Baba, that's when the absorption is taking place. You see? Because otherwise, you know, people all the time sitting in judgment over God and finding him not what they expect, which of course he never is. And so that's a bit of a waste of activity, waste of time to do that. So he talks a lot about this sort of osmosis effect. You know, when you put a few almonds in a glass of water and leave them overnight, by the morning they're fat. You know, skin comes off. Something like that. Yeah, soak in Baba's remembrance, and you absorb, you see, you absorb light, you absorb power, you absorb very, very subtle energy from Baba, And when you meditate at that level, there is progress. And you have to meditate a fair amount, and you have to be in a very good soul-conscious stage and a bodiless stage in order for this to happen. And most BKs don't really know how to meditate. And that is a mystery, but that's the way it is. So we have to really think about this, that what does it really mean to be in tune with Baba, so that we're really absorbing the power, really being on the same level, and really becoming the way he is. And so the meditation is a very important part of it, and the other is that we have to churn the Murali. And of course most people don't do that, they don't know how to churn the Murali. So you listen the Murali. Okay, I heard the Murali. You didn't hear the Murali. You just heard the rustling of the paper. But to really hear the Murali, you know, you have to read it many times so that you can penetrate into it and really find out now what's really going on in this Murali. Because you're on your piece of paper where the Murali is written, what you have is access to the mind of God. But if you're in body consciousness, you can't penetrate, you can't get in there. So you have to read it quite a few times. And then you begin to experience how much resistance you have, because your intellect is body conscious. And we have to get a soul conscious intellect. And so the words of Baba have to break through that barrier of body consciousness. So if you read the Murali once, it take you 15 minutes. Then you have to read it again. You find it'll take longer. And you read it again. You get distracted. You find that it takes a lot of power of concentration to sit with it and really read it. And the fourth time and the fifth time, it takes longer and longer. And then if you can break through this barrier of resistance by just making yourself do it, then you start to, you know, it starts to open out, it starts to show itself to you, you start to see the hidden patterns, the hidden meaning, and he starts to really talk to you, and you start to really get into it. And you go deep and deep and deep, and then you are really in tune with Baba through the Murali. So the first subject is Gyan, which includes the churning, and then that puts you into that yoga, you see. And then you're tuned, you're connected, you can stay, you can go into a bodiless stage, you can go into yoga and stay there for a long time, because you've deeply grasped what he said that day. And that's when the Dharana comes. You can start to really get what is his love, and what is his compassion, what is his gentleness, what is his balance of love and law that he talks about. You know, these things start to become real for you. And then there's change, you see. But just show up for 5 minutes meditation before the Murali, listen to the Murali, and then go about your business. That's, you know, that's not going to work. But that's what most people do. And you can't really go into the Murali at that depth on a daily basis, but you can do it from time to time. And every time you do that, it enables you to experience subsequent Muralis at a much deeper level, you see. So you've got all these thousands of people in the same room listening to the Murali, and every single one is hearing it differently. because of the way they worked on it, the churning, the depth, all this. It's just an extraordinary phenomenon that Baba, with these very simple words, is able to satisfy really simple people, but also go really deep and take you to a heavy-duty yoga, which actually makes you able to raise the energy in Maya and then deal with it. That makes you the king. And then you then start to understand what is the force of God and the force of evil. And then you find yourself, oh well, guess what? I'm in a position where I have to destroy the force of negativity, right? That's what this is all about. And then you start to see how much negativity there is, you know, in the name of ethics, in the name of morality, in the name of values. You start to see it. Once you see it, then you say, oh my goodness, what do I do about it? And this is where, you know, the conscience comes in, and you find that there's a conflict of interest between being loyal to yourself and being loyal to the culture that you're raised in, which also poisoned you. So you have to choose. And this is why it came in the video that your first loyalty is loyalty to yourself. And when you are really loyal to yourself, you know, people are going to point the finger at you and say, how dare you become free? They will say that, you know, in so many words. How dare you become free? And they will, they want what you have, but they don't want to do the work to get it. But you can't actually have that without doing the work, you know. And so we gradually become aware of this, and this inspires us to do the work and become, you know, what Baba calls the non-dependent people. And there are many Muralis about this, you see. And so so he does put us on the spot, and then he says, don't worry, you're actors. Be free internally, and then play the role, satisfy everybody, but understand that it's a role, and play the role in such a way that the people are satisfied and you don't get in bondage, you don't get trapped, you keep your freedom, you see. And then you see, he says, you know, have all relationships with me. All these other relationships, they are roles that we must discharge properly, and he's given us all the Shreemat for doing that. And then we're able to be really the ones which he calls it Jivan Mukt. You are free and you're in life, and nobody can fault you because you're doing everything very accurately, but you don't come under their influence and you don't get trapped, and they kind of don't like it, but there's nothing they can do about it because you're doing everything properly. And it's a wonder. And so Baba says, you know, just, it's a cartoon show half the time, you know. Don't take it too seriously. But your policy for yourself is really very important, because you do your karma, you get the results of it. Not that your relatives get the result of your karma, but you just have to make sure that you don't have to take the result of their karma by getting all trapped in systems that are, you know, and against your best interests, against the best interests of a healthy society. Do you see what I'm saying? Does it make sense to you? I don't know if this answers your question, Kim. Probably doesn't, but yeah? Okay, we've just gone past 6 o'clock, but there was another question that you had, so please come and then we'll have to stop.
My question is Aldo Cristina from Portugal. My question is about it's very simple, how to develop virtues, divine virtues, the difference between divine virtues and limited virtues, because sometimes Baba says that he knows that in the world outside some people have a good set of values or virtues, and sometimes Baba's children don't have that much, but still Baba's children, and they are learning. And so also, do you think to be yog-yukt, virtues, is it a method for doing things? Is it the same as to be yog-yukt, you know, like doing things in yoga and using the right virtue, the right method? Is it some similarity in between virtues and being yog-yukt, something like that?
I think if you're yog-yukt, put it this way, you have a choice. You can be body conscious, or you can be soul conscious. And what normally happens is we're body conscious. It's a default position, you're body conscious. And so then you look at yourself and you ask yourself, am I soul conscious? And then you quickly become soul conscious because you ask yourself that question. And on very rare occasions, you can ask yourself the question, am I soul conscious? And you say, hey, I am. What an amazing thing. I'm soul conscious. And that means you're getting somewhere, because you're reaching a point where soul consciousness happens naturally. But what normally happens is you say, okay, let me be soul conscious. So you be soul conscious for a few minutes, and then tick, 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 you become body conscious again, like those certain light switches which are on a timer, you know, you turn the light on and after a few minutes it turns off because of the timer. When you're soul conscious, then your spiritual qualities dominate. And when you're body conscious, then your vices dominate. And this is why he says, as much as possible, be soul conscious, because then your qualities will dominate. So in the video you heard that Magla spoke about that there's a lot of people with a lot of virtues and they not particularly involved with God. Now the thing is this, when you become a BK, you throw down the gauntlet and make a challenge to Maya. And those other people don't do that. So sometimes people say, oh, you know, all these BKs, they've got, you know, all these defects and all these, you know, ego and stuff like this, you know. And it's actually because as soon as you start remembering Baba, you activate Maya. And the other people don't do that. And so when you look at it superficially, they will very often look better. And the thing is also that if you come to Baba and you start Raj Yoga, you have to keep up, because once you've activated Maya, it's relentless. So if you say, oh, well, I'll do my Amrit Vela occasionally, it's not going to work. Once you start this, you have to keep up the practice, otherwise Maya will overtake you. And And this is why you get the situation that people who are following the practices of Amrit Vela, you know, traffic controls, Murali, evening meditation, all these things, if you're doing everything, minimum survivable amount of meditation is 3.5 hours a day. That's the basic minimum. He would like 8 hours. But if you do the Amrit Vela, the meditation before the Murali, if you do all the traffic controls, if you do evening meditation and a little bit before you sleep at night, you can clock up 3.5 hours a day quite okay. But if you don't, you tend to find that it becomes hard because you're just not accumulating enough power to handle the accumulation of Maya that's coming along to, you know, to take leave of you. But if you keep up the practice, you deal with the tests as they come. But if you don't, then that will take over. So I hope that's okay, because it's too late if it's not. Yeah, I think, you know, when you have real love for God, you will actually, you know, you will cook in meditation, you'll drive your car in meditation, you'll go for a walk in meditation, you'll do all these things, and you will actually integrate Baba's remembrance into your daily activities. But if you don't, then all of the negativity is going to really get too big, you know. So it's very important for us to do all these things, what he tells us, because we are Raja Yoga students, so we have to follow all the practices, yeah. Anyway, it's getting a little bit late, so I'm going to have to stop now. Thank you very much for coming, and I hope this is useful for you. If you want to look at any of these videos, you can go to the YouTube, and you can find them there. And if you want to be in touch with me, you can, and I can put it to you. We're trying to make a website where these videos will be easily able to be seen, and it should be up in about a month from now, which would be easier to remember as just www.rajayoga.tv, and try that in a month, and it should come up, all the different videos of this and other series and similar things, with maybe with some other people in them as well. So thank you, and Om Shanti.